The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Can the police police themselves? And how might you find out what the record is of each officer, particularly in a case where you might have had an interaction with that officer? That proposition has been investigated by WNYC investigative reporter Robert Lewis, who looked into state laws that strictly protect police misconduct records from being publicly available. He also looked at states where this information is more readily available. In addition, the WNYC award-winning data news team mapped police disciplinary records across all 50 states, letting you see at a glance that states like New York and California have some of the most restrictive laws in the nation when it comes to the public's right to know. Robert Lewis says knowledge of police conduct in those states is essentially buried underground like gold or precious gems. Lewis says other states make records much more available, perhaps as easily as one might check a book out of a public library.
In 1976, the state legislature here passed what's Section 50A of the Civil Rights Law, and it very specifically exempts law enforcement from having their personnel records disclosed, which is unlike other public employees. You work for the Department of Transportation, member of the public can go in and see whether or not you have a disciplinary history. So it's this law that very specifically exempts them, and it's been sort of expanded in its interpretation of what this means over the years to the extent that just about anything pertaining to an individual police officer, disciplinary records, civilian complaints, even incidents involving firearms, if it can be used to judge their performance, it's considered confidential.
And you might think that lawyers in court cases would be excluded from something like this and that they would have that kind of access, but you would be wrong.
If defense attorneys are given full access to a police officer's disciplinary record, which includes allegations, whether they're founded or unfounded, well, then they're absolutely going to try and use those to their client's advantage. And that could possibly sway a jury to allow a criminal to be set free when they really shouldn't be set free.
Now, that's Michael Palladino, who's the head of the New York Police Department Detectives Union, saying that lawyers shouldn't have access to this stuff.
The actual purpose of 50A, this is interesting, was to keep defense attorneys from harassing police officers in court. And one of the things that you hear from defense attorneys is that on the flip side, this keeps them from ensuring their client gets a fair trial because as a result, they say that they have a difficulty getting information that might impeach or undermine the credibility of an officer who is testifying against their client. And again, this is not just a New York issue. There was a study that was published in the Stanford Law Review earlier this year that looked at how these disciplinary records and the access to these disciplinary records impacts defendants' right to a fair trial. And what this article found was that depending on where you are arrested in the country, your access to these records very greatly influences whether or not you can push back against your accuser.
Has this ever been tested, the relevance of these kinds of records? Because they are kept, and presumably they're kept for a reason, and at some point someone would need to know about them.
Well, certainly. I mean, there are cases that bubble up periodically where somehow an officer's past history comes out after a case, after a conviction in particular. And you'll see these appeals where the defendant or where the appellate attorney will basically argue that there was a Brady or Giglio violation, which is refers to the Supreme Court cases that give a defendant a right to this type of information. And just for example, in February of this year, here in Manhattan State Court, there was a conviction overturned because the prosecutor didn't disclose to the defendant a history of lawsuits alleging false arrest. So, I mean, these are important issues. And so even prosecutors, I mean, there are a number of prosecutors' offices that are taking it upon themselves to both track this information and turn it over because they don't want their convictions overturned. They want to be able to provide this information, and they're confident that they have a strong enough case. They don't want, 3 years down the line to have someone questioning it because they didn't turn over the fact that this guy had a lawsuit.
What specific stories have you heard in cases around the nation as you've investigated this?
So I talked to defense attorneys around the country as well as prosecutors around the country to get a sense of sort of how access to these records will impact cases. For example, I spoke to a woman named Nancy Daniels, who's the elected public defender in Tallahassee.
this officer had an excessive use of force history, several complaints, in fact, even had shot a person and been investigated for that. And we brought all that before the prosecutor, and they actually dismissed the case.
This didn't even get to a jury.
Exactly. And the reason she was able to do that and her attorneys were able to do that is because Florida has one of the most open public records laws in the country. And anyone can walk in and they can get all of these personnel disciplinary records pertaining to an officer. You could not do that in New York or California or a number of other states.
Well, I gather that your series here on WNYC is really all about why New York is so different from the state of Florida. What would you say, how would you characterize New York, and what are the people you've talked to, how do they characterize New York?
Well, I would say New York has one of the most restrictive laws in the country. I spoke to a law professor, in fact, at Pace University named Bennett Gershman, who's an expert on, in particular, on prosecutorial misconduct.
The laws of New York State are very, very police-friendly here. Absolutely. And the confidentiality of these records is something that could very well produce a miscarriage of justice. Probably has, often. You know, again, that's a matter for the, you know, for the legislature in its infinite wisdom to decide to change.
What is the situation? Is it because the union is so powerful? Is it because law enforcement and prosecutors are very, very powerful politically in the state? Is it some sort of cultural tradition? Because, you know, the Garner case was extremely explosive here in the city.
There is definitely a strong belief amongst the people who are trying to change the law here that the police unions are just too powerful and they have too much sway to see any change to this. And I talked to the unions as well, and while they somewhat dismiss the claim that it's entirely because of their might, they say that the legislature listens to the concerns of their members. So there is a pending bill. I should say there's a pending bill that would at least somewhat amend the New York State law and allow a limited disclosure of a little bit of some records. So far, it's gone nowhere.
In the meantime, if we take a look at your project and the data team and you and other folks here at WNYC have put together, what do you see?
So New York is very restrictive. California is also incredibly restrictive. A state like Florida, Georgia, there it's open. And it's changing over time. I mean, in Illinois, for example, that's a good example where there were recently some case law, recently some changes that allow greater disclosure of records. In the past, attorneys there would only have access or the public would only have access to closed cases where misconduct was actually found. Well, if an officer has 30 civilian complaints against them and they're never found, the public would never know that. But maybe that matters, the fact that they had 30 complaints lodged against them. So now in Illinois, that's changed. So even unsubstantiated allegations can be disclosed. So all that's to say, these are issues that are being looked at and talked about across the country. We're seeing changes in the laws in both directions. And I think this is going to be something maybe to keep an eye on over the next couple of years.
Robert Lewis is a reporter for WNYC. He's on the investigative team taking a look at this around the United States. Thanks so much, Robert.
You're welcome.
Can you access police records in your state? Take a look at the map of Robert's findings at thetakeaway.org. How can transparency and an accessibility policy affect the practice of policing? In Connecticut, anyone can file a Freedom of Information Act request to access police personnel or disciplinary files. Joining us is Chief Gary McNamara, Police Chief of Fairfield, Connecticut. Chief McNamara, welcome to the program.
Hello, John.
How do officers and detectives and the culture of the entire force there in Fairfield, how are they affected by this policy?
You know, I don't know as though they really are affected. I think it goes towards organizational integrity as well as officer integrity. I mean, we in law enforcement know that we are a product of our past. And from day one, when you come on the job as a police officer, what you do and how you act really does follow you in most cases in a good way.
Now, you and I can both understand that, police need advocates and that unions are advocates in good faith for law enforcement officers. But when a policy of a union goes to the extreme of protecting records to the point where defense attorneys, court can't even get at these records in trials and cases of serious crimes. What do you think the impact of that is on officers? And I know you're speculating here, but what do you think the impact is?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to understand in Connecticut, it's not an open door. You can't just walk in and have the file. The officers do on occasion have times to contest that. And if there are those cases that the unions contest or the officer contests, those can go to a hearing. You know, it's not free access, unfettered access. There is an opportunity in some cases for the officers to contest the release of certain information. But, there are federal rulings, Supreme Court decisions that say that information in an officer's personnel file could be brought forward by defense attorneys so that they have an ability to see the credibility and the integrity of the police officer. It goes towards exculpatory information, whether or not the police officer is credible or whether there's something in their personnel file that would deem the officer less credible. And I think that is an important part of a fair trial that people should have. Understanding at the same time that unions play important roles in protecting officers in general.
Some of the cases that we investigated in some of the states with very, very restrictive practices as far as these records are concerned, trials were affected. What's your response to that?
You know, we have to have truth in prosecution, and truth in prosecution starts with us. We are the gateway into the law enforcement system, into the justice system. We are the gateway, and it starts with us as police officers.
Is that integrity easier to achieve when records are easier to obtain in a public sort of open meetings kind of culture or not?
I think the integrity is with the training of the officers, hiring good people, understanding what's expected of them, and good training. The fact that you have something that if you do something wrong, it's going to be discovered shouldn't be our motto. Our motto should be to train good police officers, hire them, train them well, and keep them on the right path, not saying that if you do something wrong, we'll protect you and hide that from anybody, or we'll expose it. It really shouldn't be. That shouldn't be the benchmark of law enforcement.
And transparency helps you to achieve that benchmark. Is that what you're telling me?
I believe it does. I think it does. I think we need to. We can't hide the work we do from the community.
Gary McNamara is police chief of Fairfield, Connecticut. Thanks so much, Gary.
John, thank you so much for having me.
This is Peter from Tarrytown. Considering the immense responsibility police have, and the fact that they carry weapons of deadly force, citizens have every right to know their history. Not knocking the police here at all, quite the opposite. Just trying to maintain a safe level of service in difficult situations.
Your thoughts on this one? Miami, Florida. I don't think putting every little mistake a cop makes on display is going to solve anything.
This is Jim Morgan calling from Easton, Pennsylvania. Well, it is true that cops do a tough job. I'm tired of that fact being used as an excuse not to hold them to a higher standard. The public has a right to know which police officers are a problem. There will always be a few bad apples that need to be dealt with. Covering up disciplinary records diminishes the credibility of all cops.
Let us know your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The brief Taliban success in the city of Kunduz, Afghanistan, this fall represents a much longer setback for humanitarian organizations. Threatened by violence and targeted persecution by Taliban leaders when the city was first overrun, professional, educated women who were teachers and engineers and community leaders have left, and it's not certain when or if they will ever return. One of them, Hasina Sarwati, ran a shelter for women who were victims of violence. Quote, "If we had captured her, she would be hanged in the main circle in Kunduz City," a local Taliban leader was reported as saying. Sunita Viswanath is a co-founder of Women for Afghan Women, an organization based in New York. Sunita, welcome.
Hi, John.
We're so used to thinking of evaluating military successes and failures in Afghanistan based simply on the Taliban holds the city. Oh, and now Afghan forces have rolled the Taliban back. But in this particular case, it really doesn't matter what the military situation on the ground is. The cultural damage has been done. Can you describe how you found out what's happened and how permanent it might be?
We have had many threats over the 14 years of our existence as an organization, and we react quickly to the threats. The reason we get news of tensions on the ground, dangers, is that we're a very, very grassroots organization. We work in New York City, where we were founded, in the Afghan community in Queens, but we have life-saving programs in 13 provinces across Afghanistan. And everywhere that we work, we hire locally. And so we get news immediately. The strange thing about what is happening right now is that in Kunduz, we didn't have any signs, any warnings. It's the first time. And it's a new and terrible day in Afghanistan.
Stepping back, before the Taliban went in, what roles were these women playing in creating a sense of pluralism and justice for men and women in Kunduz?
Women for Afghan Women was founded actually before 9/11, and we thought we would be taking a long time before anyone paid attention to what was happening in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Women for Afghan Women was founded during the darkest hour of Afghan history. But then, irony was that 9/11 happened, and as devastating as it was to all of us as New Yorkers and world citizens, the door opened, and people, especially Afghan expatriates, poured into Afghanistan wanting to rebuild. And it is that spirit of resilience, given security, given the opportunity to build and rebuild, the Afghan people have proven time and time again that they will face adversity and stand for progress. And Kunduz was no exception. It was one of our most dangerous provinces. From the time we opened our offices in 2010 in Kunduz, we have known that we've been on the Taliban hit list. We've known when fighting has happened and has come close. We've actually evacuated our offices in Kunduz 3 times before this. So Kunduz has definitely been a place that we've been extremely worried about. In fact, all our northern provinces. And yet, our province manager and the other women and men who staff the organization's offices are Muslim Afghans who go to work every single day to fight for women's rights. That goes against the stereotype that you will read about in the press.
What would you say is the permanence of the damage in Kunduz as a result of what's happened in the last few weeks? And I gather your determination is to rebuild, but how long is that going to take?
This we have to wait and see. There's no question that Women for Afghan Women and the women and men of Afghanistan are not going to let the country go backwards. Not after 14 years, not after all the billions of dollars and the blood that has been spilled in rebuilding Afghanistan. What we look for now in this moment of crisis in Afghanistan is a suspension of the drawdown. The extremists, Taliban and the other extremists, it's like they're waiting for 2016 because there's a sense that the U.S. troops and the international community is going to be gone. If there's a Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, that is hell for the region, and it doesn't bode well for us here in the States.
Do you think there's a victory for you and organizations like yours that the president has decided to keep more than 5,000 troops in Afghanistan after 2017?
Absolutely, and we need more. And we need, at the very least, urgently, a statement directed at these extremists that the U.S. and the international community is not going to abandon Afghanistan, its women, its men, its children. Let us do everything we can as the international community, as the United States and all our allied countries, to stand with the people of Afghanistan.
We mentioned Hasina Sarwadi, who ran this shelter, who was on a hit list. Can you describe her to me and others in Kunduz whose faces you know, whose heroism you are aware of, and whose bravery you can introduce our listeners to?
Hasina Sarwadi is one of so many Afghan heroes. I have asked her, why do you stay? Why do you do this job? And each time she will do this because it is her duty as a Muslim and as a woman to protect the lives and the rights of women and men of her country. And then I think of a young 11-year-old girl from Kunduz who was raped by a mullah her teacher, her Quranic instructor. Now, this young girl has the spirit of a more familiar name to all of the listeners, Malala Yousafzai.
It sounds like a city of Malalas.
Exactly. Kind of. And so this young girl, her case was fought by our lawyers, Women for Afghan Women's lawyers, and in an unprecedented turn of events, the rapist was put away for 20 years, even though he invoked Sharia law and said he would marry the girl and take lashings. The judge, who may have benefited from some human rights trainings, of which there is plenty going on, said, no, this was a rape and you are being put away. And then we asked about bravery. This 11-year-old girl in the courtroom, and nobody asked her to do this, removed her veil and looked the mullah in the eye and said, God will not forgive you. That young girl represents the spirit, the resilience of the people of Afghanistan at age 11. And so stand with that young girl. And please, President Obama, members of the Congress, do the needful to safeguard the progress that has been so hard won in Afghanistan over the last 14 years. President Obama has said he's sort of been shy of being committed to the sense of nation building in Afghanistan. But nation building is what we've been doing. Funding Women for Afghan Women is a part of that nation building. And we have to make sure that the country is strong before we step down.
A statement for what the United States is fighting for, or presumably fighting for, in Afghanistan, from Sunita Viswanath, who's the co-founder of Women for Afghan Women. Thanks so much, Sunita.
Thank you so much, John.
Can art be given an identifying feature that's more foolproof than, say, signatures or the authenticity declarations of expert art critics? Wolfgang Bertracci has served time in prison for art forgery. He's perhaps the greatest forger of all time, another way of saying he's a great painter in his own right, as he told the late Bob Simon on 60 Minutes last year.
Could you do a Rembrandt?
Yeah, sure.
Could you do a Leonardo?
Yeah, sure.
Who couldn't you do?
Maybe a Bellini. A Bellini is really difficult.
Bertracci made millions off his forgeries until he was arrested. And he isn't the only one. A prominent Manhattan gallery was forced to close a few years ago after selling dozens of forged pieces. What if a way could be found to put a DNA marker on art pieces? Research scientist Martin Tenniswood at Provenir Authentication is trying to do just that. Mr. Tenniswood, what do you do here? Put a footprint, a fingerprint, get the artist to lick the sculpture or painting?
No, in fact, the way this works is we've developed what we refer to as a tag, is the best way of putting it. It's a small sticker, in essence, that's about the size of a credit card, slightly thicker than a credit card, that contains a microfluidic device that allows us to load synthetic DNA into wells on the card, which can then be stuck very carefully on the back of paintings, for example, so that we can then go back and authenticate over the years by assaying and looking at the DNA that we've put into each of those wells.
So let me get this straight. It sounds like you're not necessarily using DNA from the living artist. You're actually just using DNA sequences as a kind of barcode.
Exactly. That's exactly the case. It's not DNA from the artist. It would be nice to be able to do that, but that is very easy to steal. All you need is to have an artist sip on a cup, and you can take that and figure out the DNA sequences from that. That's the way forensic DNA technology works. We have had to develop a technology that is independent of any physical attributes of the artist or anybody else, and it's actually very short sequences of DNA that we've hidden.
The fact that you're using DNA not of a particular artist but as a kind of barcode signifier means that you can go back and retrofit, retro-identify, or retro-authenticate every piece of art that exists in every museum around the world. That's a heck of a product line.
It would be. So there's a couple of things about this. Everything that we're doing has to ultimately be validated by the Global Center for Innovation for I2M, which is where this whole project started. And I think that the lifetime of this sticker as being the best methodology is probably not 50, 60 years. I think if we're still using the same technology in 50 or 60 years, I'd be very surprised, because innovation being what it is, there'll be much better technologies later on. I think we'd love to be able to tag every piece of art in the world, but that's a very large stretch. And to tag something for future provenance, you actually have to have the authentication in the present. And so those two have to be tagged when you put together when you're looking at complex, older pieces of art.
Well, obviously you have a passion for authenticating art and preventing forgeries from disrupting the art world. But I suspect if this all proves out, you can leave the classroom behind, eh?
I could. The thing is that this is actually something that came up as a result of conversations with Sam Solomon at New Reality Solutions. And the issue is that this was a side project. He asked me a question, is there a way of doing this? I thought about it and came up with what I thought was a solution. And the more we investigated it, it actually does turn out to be a very clever solution right now. But I'm actually a teacher first and a researcher, so I won't be leaving the classroom anytime soon.
Research scientist Martin Tenniswood is the lead developer of the Art DNA encryption technology at Provenir Authentication. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think of Ralph Nader, the candidate and saboteur of the 2000 election.
George Bush is the next president of the United States because I tipped six states in his favor. I would say to myself that Al Gore tipped many more than six states in George W. Bush's favor.
The lawyer and environmental anti-corporate activist.
Business is not so much opposed to Marxism or communism as they are to good old free enterprise, competitive business and consumer sovereignty. That's what really gets them all worried.
Whatever you may think, Ralph Nader has spent decades fighting for consumers, not through elections and politics mostly, but through the courts. Nader's new American Museum of Tort Law in Connecticut is a place to see how the most arcane of fine print in the law is, in fact, the linchpin of American freedom. Ralph Nader joined us from Washington, D.C. to tell us how torts are the anyone-can-play way to confront corrupt power in America. They are a precious resource worth devoting a museum to.
Tort law is an accountability mechanism. We have the best tort system in the world with all its warts. It's heavily underutilized. Not 10% of the people who are wrongfully injured, John, even get to a lawyer. However, structurally, it is the best example of direct democracy. You know, when you try to influence the legislature, you got to beg or pay. You try to do something with the executive branch, it's a morass of bureaucracy, delay, and expense. But when you decide you're going to sue General Motors because you were injured from a ignition switch defect, which, of course, has been in the news, only you have to make that decision.
You love to take on the corporations, and for good and solid policy reasons and safety reasons. But I'm wondering if you could tell the story of someone you defended who felt so completely powerless in their case, and you proved to them that they did, in fact, have power, something early in your career.
Well, there are a lot of cases. The one I remember are the coal miners who were dying from coal mine pneumoconiosis, that's called black lung disease, from ingesting day after day the fine coal dust when they went deep into the mines to mine coal. They were in their mid-40s. They knew that they were going to die soon. They knew that they couldn't get compensation before our legislation passed. And we brought some of them to the U.S. Senate before a highly coal industry indentured senators, including Jennings Randolph from West Virginia, who opposed our effort to get legislation to compensate the widows and orphans when these coal miners gave their life for their coal company. And so we brought them to the Senate hearing with their doctors, and our doctors asked them to stand up. And in front of a packed Senate hearing with media, they jumped up or down for 5 seconds and were completely out of breath. And then the doctors showed the senators a diseased black lung in a glass container with formaldehyde. And that, more than anything else, not only got the law through, got billions of dollars for the widows and orphans in succeeding years, but it vindicated what these poor coal miners had gone through. And although it wasn't a judicial decision, it was a very gratifying experience for those of us who had the privilege to defend them.
What do you hope families and visitors to the museum get out of it?
They should get an awareness, first of all, of the historic benefits to their health, safety, and their freedom from the civil justice system and right of trial by jury over 200 and some years. And second, that it's still available for them, that they have a duty, if they are wrongfully injured or their relatives or friends are wrongfully injured, to go to court, not be sheepish about it, because they're not only holding perpetrators accountable so they don't do it again to other innocent people, but beyond that, when they file a lawsuit, the press is informed and they send deterrent signals to corporations all over the country who in effect say to themselves, hey, we better clean up our act because we may be sued too.
Now, can you find in the museum the cases that just seem opportunistic and attempts to just get a jury to give someone some money for being annoyed as opposed to being really hurt?
There's an elaborate exhibit on the McDonald's hot coffee case, which was used in a very unfair, distorted way by the wrongdoers lobby, as I call them, to get what they call tort reform and restrict people's rights to have their day in court if they're wrongfully injured. And most media laughed at it. Comedians on late night TV laughed at it. But the basic facts are she was not driving. She was in the car. She had a McDonald's coffee in a styrofoam cup. And what the facts were that changed the mind of the judge and jury were that McDonald's had its coffee at 190 degrees for commercial advantage against Burger King and other fast food outlets because it wanted its coffee to stay longer down the highway. It didn't warn that 190 degrees burns you in 3 seconds compared to other coffee you buy that may take 15 or 20 seconds and give you time for precautionary behavior. And, of course, it didn't warn that it was completely scalding compared to the coffee you brew in your kitchen. And that's why the jury said, oh, there are 800 people who've been burned that McDonald's revealed in their cases. This is an actionable tort.
That Corvair that's there in the museum, is it a trophy? Is it a sign of egregious abuse by the part of corporations?
It's the centerpiece in the museum because that's what led General Motors to hire private detectives to follow me in 1965-66 to get dirt on me, to discredit my coming testimony before the U.S. Senate, and to discredit my book, Unsafe at Any Speed. And it backfired, and GM had to come through its president, James Roach, in a highly media-covered Senate hearing and apologize for the detectives. And I sued them for invasion of privacy and used the proceeds to monitor and challenge and hold the auto industry and other companies accountable. So it has a storied existence, this Corvair. It killed a lot of people, injured a lot of people, but it produced the public outrage and the public attention to get the motor vehicle and highway safety laws through that have saved over 1 million lives and required foreign car imports to adhere to higher safety standards to sell in this market.
Is it the case that Patti Smith, the singer, came to your opening?
Yes, she did. She closed the convocation with two songs. One is her famous song titled Wing, and then her great song, The People Have the Power. And that was very appropriate because the theme of opening day in Winston, Connecticut was the jury system of, by, and for the people.
Ralph Nader, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Ralph Nader is a consumer advocate and founder of the American Museum of Tort Law. His newest book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.